Welcome to the podcast series, Planning for Autism in Communities and Schools, with Dr. Tina Fletcher, Professor of Occupational Therapy at Texas Woman's University. Along with many neurotypical and neurodiverse colleagues, Dr. Fletcher has worked with community agencies and schools to tear down barriers and build up supports for autistic community members. And now, Dr. Tina Fletcher.
Today we're going to be talking about meeting autistic people wherever they are with mobile sensory havens. And this is one of my favorite topics. And here's a piece of trivia about me. I live in Texas. It's really hot, but I probably know a lot more about ice fishing houses than your average Texan. And it's because I use them in mobile sensory havens. Now, as a school teacher, I've got to have my learning goals for you. So here's your three goals for the day. We're going to talk about why sensory havens are needed in the community. You should be able to say that. You should also be able to identify the factors that are considered when creating sensory havens. And last goal for you is that you would be able to at least briefly discuss some of the advantages of having a portable model instead of a fixed sensory haven. Now, you're probably thinking, I don't even know what we're talking about, so I'm going to get going here and demystify this whole thing to you. As our world trends toward destigmatizing people who have autism, it's definitely becoming more normal to see neurodiverse children and adults in community settings and participating in events that are both specifically designed for them as well as everyday events for the larger population. This is something that many people, including occupational therapists like myself, special educators, speech and language pathologists, and families all love to see, but there's still a lot of hurdles to overcome before true full participation can be achieved for people with sensory sensitivities, communication difficulties, and social differences. Now, as OT practitioners, that's us, occupational therapists, and my students, we can offer our support and knowledge of evidence-based mobile sensory havens to staff and volunteers of organizations. What do I mean by evidence-based? It means that we've done some of the legwork for you. We've looked things up. We've been able to evaluate what we read. And I don't mean just on the internet. I mean in research databases. And we understand that a lot of people in organizations in the community really don't have the same benefit of the training or the access to that research information to better include neurodiverse individuals during special events. So let us help you. First and foremost, visiting sensory havens really shouldn't be seen as going to a therapy session in the middle of your zoo day or museum date. Instead, they provide opportunities for neurodiverse people and their loved ones to continue enjoying what they are doing in the community by offering them an opportunity to settle or calm down, and really a 5 or 10 minute visit to a well-appointed sensory haven should be all it takes to pull it together and get out there and enjoy the event some more. The concept of sensory havens is really backed by research evidence about sensory processing and a system called multisensory environments, which comes from Holland, and autism architecture, which I love this, comes from Egypt, and literature on social participation, which comes from everywhere. So from our perspective as therapists and having tons of personal experience trying to meet the expectations of community partners in events, it's really easy to buy the things needed for sensory haven, and they're just out there, and they really increase the popularity of these places because this is not rocket science. It's really like curating what you need and how to get it. So with all these things in mind, the goal of a sensory space is to provide community visitors with what Russian sensory room psychologists refer to as the calming, refreshing, and activating effects, and what Italian magic room designers and biomedical engineers have described as places for children with and without disabilities to increase their positive behavior socialization, and relaxation. And what I like about the Italian magic room designers is they are implying that all of these spaces that help kids who have disabilities also help kids that don't have disabilities, just typical kids. Now, when factoring in both autism architecture, which was developed by Egyptian research architect Mostafa, and Patricia Wilbarger, who is a therapist, early work in 1991 in sensory processing, the most sensory havens usually incorporate tactile, and by tactile, I mean deep pressure, like bear hug type tactile, vestibular, which means the back to front porch swing type of input, proprioceptive, which is where is my body in space astronaut type input, and auditory and visual input into a design. And so it's a good plan to avoid, here's the stuff you don't want in there, invasive olfactory, meaning inescapable smells, which could be good or bad, and potentially messy, what we call gustatory or taste input. So just going back to it, it's like, what's good? Tactile, vestibular, proprioceptive, auditory, and visual. What's not good? Smells and taste. So a sensory space should be easy to recreate and to customize. And so once you figure out your own formula for success, you should hope to reliably make the same space from one event to another, and you can tailor them to whatever comes up, whatever needs arrive. So when visitors are able to make their own choice, consider offering one sensory space that has lights and sounds and another one without any visual or auditory input, something like a darkened calm zone. Keeping the amount of equipment to a minimum will also allow the havens to be easier for you to recreate and make setup way more consistent between groups and places. So in this case, being a copycat is a good thing. But before you settle on imitating your neighbor's design, ask them how they like it. And honestly, it's quite possibly they would like to tweak it. Using something that is easy to transport and assemble. All right, here's my list of favorite things, like a floorless ice fishing house or a heavy-duty camping tent, but practically speaking, those get dirty, or even a cardboard playhouse, which you can buy on some of our favorite internet shopping channels. They really cut down on setup time considerably, and it's possible to put them up wherever they are the most convenient for users. And another benefit of using a variety of ice fishing houses, tents, and cardboard houses that vary in sizes and shapes is that it will help community venues accommodate for users of all different age groups and sensory needs. Not everybody is the same size. Not everybody has the same physical skills to get in and out of these spaces. So having a mobile sensory space allows venues to have them available for use without taking up large amounts of space or detracting from the main experience that individuals are at the venue for. Plus, going the portable route is much more economical than building up a large physical space that has to stay that way. Choices related to creating mobile sensory havens depend a lot on the place they will be housed in. In a way, this is going to sound maybe strange to some of you, but think about it. Building a sensory haven is a lot like balancing a math equation. The louder and more crowded the venue is, the greater the need is for calming and providing sensory regulation opportunities in the sensory space. And likewise, the more visitors the space has, the greater the number of supports there will need to be. And speaking to you as a person who was a school therapist for a long time, the more often little bitty kids visit the space, the greater the need to clean and sanitize the spaces. So try the sensory spaces out yourself. And we're all sensory creatures. And the need for a pause that refreshes shouldn't be limited to autistic visitors, because we can all use a break.
You've been listening to Dr. Tina Fletcher. Thank you to the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board who made this podcast series possible. And special thanks for many community partners with and without autism who steadily work to tear down barriers and build up supports for autistic community members. We'll see you next time.